when a rock suddenly crashed in through Albert Humbert's window, spraying glass across the floor. Chapter 33. Richard in the Dark. Richard screamed and threw an arm up to shield his face. Glass flew.
"Send him out, Sloat!"
Jack got up. Dull fury filled him. Richard grabbed his arm. "Jack, no, stay away from the window." "Fuck that," Jack almost snarled. "I'm tired of being talked about like I was a pizza." The Etheridge thing stood across the road. It was on the sidewalk at the edge of the quad, looking up at them. "Get out of here," Jack shouted at it. A sudden inspiration burst in his head like a sun flare. He hesitated, then bellowed, "I order you out of here, all of you. I order you to leave in the name of my mother, the Queen." The Etheridge thing flinched as if someone had used a whip to lay a stripe across its face. Then the look of pain, surprise passed, and the Etheridge thing began to grin.
"She's dead, sire," it shouted up.
But Jack's eyes had grown sharper somehow in his time on the road, and he saw the expression of twitchy unease under the manufactured triumph.
"Queen Laura's dead, and your mother's dead, too. Dead back in New Hampshire. Dead and stinking."
"Be gone," Jack bellowed, and he thought that the Etheridge thing flinched back in baffled fury again. Richard had joined him at the window, pallid and distracted. "What are you two yelling about?" he asked. He looked fixedly at the grinning travesty below them and across the way. "How does Etheridge know your mother's in New Hampshire?"
"Sloat," the Etheridge thing yelled up, "where's your tie?"
A spasm of guilt contracted Richard's face. His hands jerked toward the open neck of his shirt.
"We'll let it go this time if you send out your passenger, Sloat," the Etheridge thing yelled up. "If you send him out, everything can go back to the way it was. You want that, don't you?"
Richard was staring down at the Etheridge thing, nodding, Jack was sure of it, quite unconsciously. His face was a knotted rag of misery, his eyes bright with unshed tears. He wanted everything to go back to the way it had been, oh yes.
"Don't you love this school, Sloat?"
the Etheridge thing bellowed up at Albert's window.
"Yes," Richard muttered and gulped down a sob. "Yes, of course I love it."
"You know what we do to little punks who don't love this school? Give him to us. It'll be like he was never here."
Richard turned slowly and looked at Jack with dreadfully blank eyes.
"You decide, Richie boy," Jack said softly.
"He's carrying drugs, Richard," the Etheridge thing called up. 4 or 5 different kinds. Coke, hash, angel dust. He's been selling all of that stuff to finance his trip west. Where do you think he got that nice coat he was wearing when he showed up on your doorstep?"
"Drugs," Richard said with great shuddery relief. "I knew it."
"But you don't believe it," Jack said. "Drugs didn't change your school, Richard." And the dog,
"Send him out, Sloat."
The Etheridge thing's voice was fading, fading. When the two boys looked down again, it was gone. "Where did your father go, do you think?" Jack asked softly. "Where do you think he went when he didn't come out of the closet, Richard?" Richard turned slowly to look at him, and Richard's face, usually so calm and intelligent and serene, now began to shiver into pieces. His chest began to hitch irregularly. Richard suddenly fell into Jack's arms, clutching at him with a blind, panicky urgency.
It touched me,
he screamed at Jack. His body trembled under Jack's hands like a winch wire under a near-breaking strain.
It touched me. Something in there touched me, and I don't know what it was.
With his burning forehead pressed against Jack's shoulder, Richard coughed out the story he had held inside him all these years. It came in hard little chunks, like deformed bullets. As he listened, Jack found himself remembering the time his own father had gone into the garage and had come back 2 hours later from around the block.
That had been bad, but what had happened to Richard had been a lot worse. It explained Richard's iron, no-compromise insistence on reality, the whole reality, and nothing but the reality. It explained his rejection of any sort of fantasy, even science fiction. And, Jack knew from his own school experience, technies like Richard usually ate and drank SF. As long as it was the hard stuff, that was, your basic Heinlein, Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Larry Niven, spare us the metaphysical bullshit of the Robert Silverbergs and Barry Maltzbergs, please, but we'll read the stuff where they get all the stellar quadrants and logarithms right until it's running out of our ears. Not Richard, though. Richard's dislike of fantasy ran so deep that he would not pick up any novel unless it was an assignment. As a kid, he had let Jack pick out the books he read for free choice book reports, not caring what they were, chewing them up as if they were cereal. It became a challenge to Jack to find a story, any story, which would please Richard, divert Richard, carry Richard away, as good novels and stories sometimes carry Jack away. The good ones, he thought, were almost as good as the daydreams, and each mapped out its own version of the territories. But he was never able to produce any frisson, any spark, any reaction at all. Whether it was the Red Pony, Dragstrip Demon, The Catcher in the Rye, or I Am Legend, the reaction was always the same. Frowning, dull-eyed concentration, followed by a frowning, dull-eyed book report that would earn either a hook, or, if his English teacher was feeling particularly generous that day, a B-. Richard's C's in English were what kept him off the honor roll during the few marking periods when he missed it. Jack had finished William Golding's Lord of the Flies, feeling hot and cold and trembly all over, both exalted and frightened, most of all wishing what he always wished when the story was most particularly good, that it didn't have to stop, that it could just roll on and on the way that life did, only life was always so much more boring and so much more pointless than stories. He knew Richard had a book report due, and so he had given him the lap-eared paperback, thinking that this must surely do it. This would turn the trick. Richard must react to the story of these lost boys and their descent into savagery. But Richard had plodded through Lord of the Flies as he had plodded through all the other novels before it, and wrote another book report which contained all the zeal and fire of a hungover pathologist's post-mortem on a traffic accident victim. "What is it with you?" Jack had burst out, exasperated. "What in God's name have you got against a good story, Richard?" And Richard had looked at him, flabbergasted, apparently not really understanding Jack's anger. "Well, there's really no such thing as a good made-up story, is there?" Richard had responded. Jack had gone away that day sorely puzzled by Richard's total rejection of make-believe. But he thought he understood better now, better than he really wanted to, perhaps. Perhaps to Richard each opening storybook cover had looked a little like an opening closet door. Perhaps each bright paperback cover, illustrating people who never were as if they were perfectly real, reminded Richard of the morning when he had had enough forever. Richard sees his father go into the closet in the big front bedroom, pulling the folding door shut behind him. He is 5, maybe, or 6, surely not as old as 7. He waits 5 minutes, then 10, and when his father still hasn't come out of the closet, he begins to be a little frightened. He calls. He calls for his pipe, he calls for his bowl, he calls for his father, and when his father doesn't answer, he calls in a louder and louder voice, and he goes closer and closer to the closet as he calls. And finally, when 15 minutes have gone by and his father still hasn't come out, Richard pulls the folding door open and goes in. He goes into darkness like a cave. And something happens. After pushing through the rough tweeds and the smooth cottons and the occasional slick silks of his father's coats and suits and sports jackets, the smell of cloth and mothballs and closed-up dark closet air begins to give way to another smell, a hot, fiery smell. Richard begins to blunder forward, screaming his father's name, he thinking there must be a fire back here and his father may be burning in it because it smells like a fire, and suddenly he realizes that the boards are gone under his feet and he is standing in black dirt. Weird black insects with clustered eyes on the ends of long stalks are hopping all around his fuzzy slippers. "Daddy!" he screams. The coats and suits are gone. The floor is gone. But it isn't crisp white snow underfoot. It's stinking black dirt, which is apparently the birthing ground for these unpleasant black jumping insects. This place is by no stretch of the imagination Narnia. Other screams answer Richard's scream, screams and mad, demented laughter. Smoke drifts around him on a dark, idiot wind, and Richard turns, stumbling back the way he came, hands outstretched like the hands of a blind man, feeling frantically for the coats, smelling for the faint, acrid reek of mothballs. And suddenly a hand slithers around his wrist. "Daddy?" he asks, but when he looks down, he sees not a human hand, but a scaly green thing covered with writhing suckers, a green thing attached to a long, rubbery arm, which stretches off into the darkness and toward a pair of yellow, upslanted eyes that stare at him with flat hunger. Screeching, he tears free and flings himself blindly into the black. And just as his groping fingers find his father's sport coats and suits again, as he hears the blessed rational sound of jangling coat hangers, that green sucker-lined hand waltzes dryly across the back of his neck again and is gone. He waits, trembling, as pallid as day-old ashes in a cold stove, for 3 hours outside that damned closet, afraid to go back in, afraid of the green hand and the yellow eyes, more and more sure that his father must be dead. And when his father comes back into the room near the end of the fourth hour, not from the closet, but from the door which communicates between the bedroom and the upstairs hall, the door behind Richard, when that happens, Richard rejects fantasy for good and all. Richard negates fantasy. Richard refuses to deal with fantasy or treat with it or compromise with it. He has, quite simply, had enough. Forever. He jumps up, runs to his father, to the beloved Morgan Sloat, and hugs him so tightly that his arms will be sore all that week. Morgan lifts him up, laughs, and asks him why he looks so pale. Richard smiles and tells him that it was probably something he ate for breakfast, but he feels better now, and he kisses his father's cheek and smells the beloved smell of mingled sweat and Raj cologne. And later that day he takes all of his storybooks, the little golden books, the pop-up books, the I Can Read books, the Dr. Seuss books, the green fairy book for young folks, and he puts them in a carton, and he puts the carton down in the basement. And he thinks, I would not care if an earthquake came now and opened a crack in the floor and swallowed up every one of those books. In fact, it would be a relief. In fact, it would be such a relief that I would probably laugh all day and most of the weekend. This does not happen, but Richard feels a great relief when the books are shut in double darkness, the darkness of the carton and the darkness of the cellar. He never looks at them again, just as he never goes in his father's closet with a folding door again. And although he sometimes dreams that there is something under his bed or in his closet, something with flat yellow eyes, he never thinks about that green sucker-covered hand again until the strange time comes to Thayer School, and he bursts into unaccustomed tears in his friend Jack Sawyer's arms. He has had enough. Forever. Jack had hoped that with the telling of his story and the passing of his tears, Richard would return more or less to his normal, sharply rational self. Jack didn't really care if Richard bought the whole 9 yards or not. If Richard could just reconcile himself to accepting the leading edge of this craziness, he could turn his formidable mind to helping Jack find a way out, a way off the Thayer campus anyway, and out of Richard's life before Richard went totally bananas. But it didn't work that way. When Jack tried to talk to him to tell Richard about the time his own father, Phil, had gone into the garage and hadn't come out, Richard refused to listen. The old secret of what had happened that day in the closet was out. Sort of. Richard still clung stubbornly to the idea that it had been a hallucination.
but Richard had still had enough forever. The next morning Jack went downstairs. He got all of his own things, and those things he thought Richard might want, toothbrush, textbooks, notebooks, a fresh change of clothes. They would spend that day in Albert the Blob's room, he decided. They could keep an eye on the quad and the gate from up there. When night fell again, maybe they could get away. Jack hunted through Albert's desk and found a bottle of baby aspirin. He looked at this for a moment, thinking that these little orange pills said almost as much about the departed Albert's loving mom as the carton of licorice whips on the closet shelf. Jack shook out half a dozen pills. He gave them to Richard, and Richard took them absently. "Come on over here and lie down," Jack said. "No," Richard answered. His tone was cross and restless and terribly unhappy. He returned to the window.
"I ought to keep a watch, Jack. If this sort of thing is going to happen, someone ought to keep a watch, so a full report can be made to the trustees later."
Jack touched Richard's brow lightly, and although it was cool, almost chilly, he said, "Your fever's worse, Richard. Better lie down until that aspirin goes to work."
"Worse?"
Richard looked at him with pathetic gratitude.
"Is it?"
"It is," Jack said gravely. "Come on and lie down." Richard was asleep 5 minutes after he lay down. Jack sat in Albert the Blob's easy chair, its seat nearly as sprung as the middle of Albert's mattress. Richard's pale face glowed waxily in the growing daylight. Somehow the day passed, and around 4 o'clock Jack fell asleep. He awoke to darkness, not knowing how long he had been out. He only knew there had been no dreams, and for that he was grateful. Richard was stirring uneasily, and Jack guessed he would be up soon. He stood and stretched, wincing at the stiffness in his back. He went to the window, looked out, and stood motionless, eyes wide. His first thought was, "I don't want Richard to see this, not if I can help it." "Oh, God, we've got to get out of here, and just as soon as we can," Jack thought, frightened, "even if for whatever reasons they're afraid to come straight at us." But was he really going to take Richard out of here? They didn't think he would do it, he knew that. They were counting on his refusing to expose his friend to any more of this craziness. "Flip, Jacko. You've got to flip over, and you know it. And you've got to take Richard with you, because this place is going to hell." "I can't." Flipping into the territories would blow Richard's wheels completely. "Doesn't matter. You have to do it. It's the best thing anyway, maybe the only thing, because they won't be expecting it." "Jack?" Richard was sitting up. His face had a strange, naked look without his glasses. "Jack, is it over? Was it a dream?" Jack sat down on the bed and put an arm around Richard's shoulders. "No," he said, his voice low and soothing. "It's not over yet, Richard."
"I think my fever is worse,"
Richard announced, pulling away from Jack. He drifted over to the window, one of the bows of his glasses pinched delicately between the thumb and forefinger of his right hand. He put his spectacles on and looked out. Shapes with glowing eyes roamed back and forth. He stood there for a long time, and then he did something so un-Richard-like that Jack could barely credit it. He took his glasses off again and deliberately dropped them. There was a frigid little crunch as one lens cracked. Then he stepped deliberately back on them, shattering both lenses to powder. He picked them up, looked at them, and then tossed them unconcernedly toward Albert the Blob's wastebasket. He missed by a wide margin. There was now something softly stubborn in Richard's face, too, something that said, "I don't want to see any more, so I won't see any more, and I have taken care of the problem. I have had enough forever." "Look at that," he said in a flat, unsurprised voice. "I broke my glasses. I had another pair, but I broke them in gym 2 weeks ago. I'm almost blind without them." Jack knew this wasn't true, but he was too flabbergasted to say anything. He could think of absolutely no appropriate response to the radical action Richard had just taken. It had been too much like a calculated last-ditch stand against madness.
I think my fever's worse, too, Richard said. Have you got any more of those aspirin, Jack?
Jack opened the desk drawer and wordlessly handed Richard the bottle. Richard swallowed 6 or 8 of them, then lay down again. As the night deepened, Richard, who repeatedly promised to discuss their situation, repeatedly went back on his word. He couldn't discuss leaving, he said, couldn't discuss any of this. Not now. His fever had come back, and it felt much, much worse. He thought it might be as high as 105, possibly 106. He said he needed to go back to sleep.
"Richard, for Christ's sake!" Jack roared. "You're punking out on me! Of all the things I never expected from you, don't be silly!"
Richard said, falling back onto Albert's bed. "I'm just sick, Jack. You can't expect me to talk about all these crazy things when I'm sick."
"Richard, do you want me to go away and leave you?"
Richard looked back over his shoulder at Jack for a moment, blinking slowly.
"You won't," he said, and then went back to sleep.
Around 9 o'clock, the campus entered another of those mysterious quiet periods, and Richard, perhaps sensing that there would be less strain put on his tottering sanity now, woke up and swung his legs over the bed. Brown spots had appeared on the walls, and he stared at them until he saw Jack coming toward him.
"I feel a lot better, Jack," he said hastily, "but it really won't do us any good to talk about leaving. It's dark, and we have to leave tonight."
Jack said grimly. "All they have to do is wait us out. There's fungus growing on the walls, and don't tell me you don't see that." Richard smiled with a blind tolerance that nearly drove Jack mad. He loved Richard, but he could cheerfully have pounded him through the nearest fungus-rotted wall. At that precise moment, long, fat, white bugs began to squirm into Albert the Blob's room. They came pushing out of the brown fungoid spots on the wall as if the fungus were in some unknown way giving birth to them. They twisted and writhed half in and half out of the soft brown spots, then plopped to the floor and began squirming blindly toward the bed. Jack had begun to wonder if Richard's sight weren't really a lot worse than he remembered, or if it had degenerated badly since he had last seen Richard. Now he saw that he had been right the first time. Richard could see quite well. He certainly wasn't having any trouble picking up the gelatinous things that were coming out of the walls anyway. He screamed and pressed against Jack, his face frantic with revulsion.
"Bugs, Jack! Oh, Jesus, bugs! Bugs!"
"We'll be all right. Right, Richard?" Jack said. He held Richard in place with a strength he didn't know he had. "We'll just wait for the morning, right? No problem, right?"
They were squirming out in dozens, in hundreds, plump, waxy white things, like overgrown maggots. Some burst open when they struck the floor. The rest humped sluggishly across the floor toward them.
"Bugs! Jesus, we have to get out! We have to thank God this kid finally sees the light," Jack said.
He slung his knapsack over his left arm and grabbed Richard's elbow in his right hand. He hustled Richard to the door. White bugs squashed and splattered under their shoes. Now they were pouring out of the brown patches in a flood, an obscene, ongoing multiple birth that was happening all over Albert's room. A stream of the white bugs fell from a patch on the ceiling and landed squirming on Jack's hair and shoulders. He brushed them away as best he could and hauled the screaming, flailing Richard out the door.
"I think we're on our way," Jack thought. "God help us, I really think we are."
They were in the common room again. Richard, it turned out, had even less idea of how to sneak off the Thayer campus than Jack did himself. Jack knew one thing very well. He was not going to trust that deceptive quiet and go out of any Nelson House's entry doors. Looking hard to the left out of the wide common room window, Jack could see a squat, octagonal brick building.
"What's that, Richard?"
"Huh?"
Richard was looking at the gluey, sluggish torrents of mud flowing over the darkening quad. "Little squatty brick building. You can just barely see it from here."
"Oh, the depot."
"What's a depot?"
"The name itself doesn't mean anything anymore," Richard said,
still looking uneasily out at the mud-drenched quad.
"Like our infirmary,"
It's called the Creamery because there used to be a real dairy barn and milk bottling plant over there. Until 1910 or so there was, anyway. Tradition, Jack. It's very important. It's one of the reasons I like Thayer.
Richard looked forlornly out at the muddy campus again.
One of the reasons I always did, anyway.
The Creamery. Okay, how come the depot?
Richard was slowly warming to the twin ideas of Thayer and tradition.
This whole area of Springfield used to be a railhead, he said. In fact, in the old days, which old days are we talking about, Richard?
Oh, the 1880s, 1890s. You see,
Richard trailed off. His nearsighted eyes began moving around the common room, looking for more bugs, Jack supposed. There weren't any, at least not yet. But he could already see a few brown patches beginning to form on the walls. The bugs weren't here yet, but they would be along.
"Come on, Richard," Jack prompted. "No one used to have to prime you to get you to run your mouth."
Richard smiled a little. His eyes returned to Jack.
"Springfield was one of the three or four biggest American railheads during the last two decades of the 19th century. It was geographically handy to all the points of the compass."
He raised his right hand toward his face, forefinger extended to push his glasses up on his nose in a scholarly gesture, realized they were no longer there, and lowered the hand again, looking a bit embarrassed.
"There were main mail routes leaving Springfield for everywhere. This school exists because Andrew Thayer saw the possibilities. He made a fortune in rail shippage, mostly to the West Coast. He was the first one to see the potential in shipping west as well as east."
A bright light suddenly went on in Jack's head, bathing all of his thoughts in its harsh glare. West Coast? His stomach lurched. He could not yet identify the new shape that bright light had shown him, but the word that leaped into his mind was fiery and utterly clear. Talisman.
West Coast, did you say?
Of course I did. Richard looked at Jack strangely.
Jack, are you going deaf?
No, Jack said. Springfield was one of the three or four biggest American railheads.
No, I'm fine.
He was the first one to see the potential in shipping west.
Well, you look damn funny for a minute.
He was, you might say, the first one to see the potential of shipping stuff by rail to the outposts. Jack knew, utterly knew, that Springfield was still a pressure point of some kind, perhaps still a shipping point. That was, perhaps, why Morgan's magic worked so well here.
There were coal piles and switching yards and roundhouses and boxcar sheds and about a billion miles of tracks and sidings, Richard was saying. It covered this whole area where Thayer School is now. If you dig down a few feet under this turf anywhere, you find cinders and pieces of rail and all sorts of stuff. But all that's left now is that little building, the depot. Of course, it never was a real depot. It's too small. Anyone could see that. It was the main rail yard office, where the station master and the rail boss did their respective things.
"You know a hell of a lot about it," Jack said, speaking almost automatically. His head was still filled with that savage new light.
"It's part of the Thayer tradition," Richard said simply.
"What's it used for now?"
"There's a little theater in there. It's for Dramatics Club productions, but the Dramatics Club hasn't been very active over the last couple of years."
"Do you think it's locked?"
"Why would anyone lock the depot?" Richard asked. "Unless you think someone would be interested in stealing a few flats from the 1979 production of The Fantastics."
"So we could get in there?"
"I think so, yes."
"But why?" Jack pointed to a door just beyond the ping-pong tables.
"What's in there?"
"Vending machines, and a coin-out microwave to heat up snacks and frozen dinners."
"Jack, come on. Jack, I think my fever's coming back again."
Richard smiled weakly.
"Maybe we should just stay here for a while. We could just rack out on those sofas for the night."
"See those brown patches on the walls?" Jack said grimly, pointing.
"No. Not without my glasses, of course not."
"Well, they're there, and in about an hour those white bugs are going to hatch out of..."
"All right,"
Richard said hastily. The vending machine stank. It looked to Jack as if all the stuff inside them had spoiled. Blue mold coated the cheese crackers and Doritos and Jacks and fried pork rinds. Sluggish creaks of melted ice cream were oozing out of the panels in the front of the Have-A-Cone machine. Jack pulled Richard toward the window. He looked out. From here, Jack could make out the depot quite well. Beyond it, he could see the chain-link fence and the service road leading off campus.
"We'll be out in a few seconds," Jack whispered back.
He unlocked the window and ran it up.
"This school exists because Andrew Thayer saw the possibilities. Do you see the possibilities, Jacko?"
He thought maybe he did.
"Are any of those people out there?" Richard asked nervously.
"No," Jack said, taking only the most cursory of glances. It didn't really matter if there were or not anymore. One of the three or four biggest American railheads, a fortune in rail shippage, mostly to the West Coast. He was the first one to see the potential in shipping west. West, west. A thick, mucky mixture of tidal flat aroma and garbage stench drifted in the window. Jack threw one leg over the sill and grabbed for Richard's hand.
"Come on," he said.
Richard drew back, his face long and miserable with fright.
"Jack, I don't know.
The place is falling apart," Jack said, "and pretty soon it's going to be crawling with bugs as well. Now come on. Someone's going to see me sitting here in this window, and we'll lose our chance to scurry out of here like a couple of mice."
"I don't understand any of this," Richard wailed. "I don't understand what in the goddamn hell is going on here."
"Shut up and come on," Jack said, "or I will leave you, Richard. Swear to God I will. I love you, but my mother is dying. I'll leave you to fend for yourself." Richard looked at Jack's face and saw, even without his glasses, that Jack was telling the truth. He took Jack's hand.
"God, I'm scared," he whispered.
"Join the club," Jack said, and pushed him off. His feet hit the mucky lawn a second later. Richard jumped down beside him.
"We're going to cross to the depot," Jack whispered. "I make it about 50 yards.
We'll go in if it's unlocked, try to hide as well as we can on the Nelson House side of it if it isn't. Once we're sure no one's seen us and the place is still quiet, we go for the fence."
"Right.
Or maybe we'll have to flip, but never mind that just now.
The service road.
I've got an idea that if we can get off the Thayer grounds, everything will be okay again. Once we get a quarter of a mile down the road, you may look back over your shoulder and see the lights in the dorms and the library just as usual, Richard."
"That'd be so great," Richard said, with a wistfulness that was heartbreaking.
"Okay. You ready?"
"I guess so," Richard said.
"Run to the depot. Freeze against the wall on this side. Low, so those bushes screen you. See them?"
"Yes."
"Okay. Go for it." They broke away from Nelson House and ran for the depot side by side. They were less than halfway there, breath puffing out of their mouths in clear white vapor, feet pounding the mucky ground, when the bells in the chapel broke into a hideous, grinding jangle of sound. A howling chorus of dogs answered the bells. They were back, all these were-prefects. Jack groped for Richard and found Richard groping for him, their hands linked together. Richard screamed and tried to pull him off to the left. His hand tightened down on Jack's until the finger bones grated together paralyzingly. A lean white wolf, a bored chairman of wolves, came around the depot and was now racing toward them. That was the old man from the limousine, Jack thought. Other wolves and dogs followed, and then Jack realized with sick surety that some of them were not dogs. Some of them were half-transformed boys, some grown men, teachers, he supposed.
"Mr. Duffery!"
Richard shrieked, pointing with his free hand. "Gee, you see pretty well for someone who's lost his glasses, Richie boy," Jack thought crazily.
"Mr. Duffery! Oh, God, it's Mr. Duffery! Mr. Duffery! Mr. Duffery!"
So Jack got his first and only look at Thayer School's headmaster, a tiny old man with gray hair, a big bent nose, and the wizened, hairy body of an organ grinder's monkey. He ran swiftly along on all fours with the dogs and the boys, a mortar board bobbing crazily up and down on his head and somehow refusing to fall off. He grinned at Jack and Richard, and his tongue, long and lolling and stained yellow with nicotine, fell out through the middle of his grin.
"Mr. Duffery, oh God, oh dear God, Mr. Duffery, Mr. Duffery!"
He was yanking Jack harder and harder toward the left. Jack was bigger, but Richard was in the grip of panic. Explosions rocked the air. That foul, garbagey smell grew thicker and thicker. Jack could hear the soft flopping and plopping of mud squeezing out of the earth. The white wolf which led the pack was closing the distance, and Richard was trying to pull them away from it, trying to pull them toward the fence. And that was right, but it was wrong, too. It was wrong because it was the depot they had to get to, not the fence. That was the spot. That was the spot because this had been one of the three or four biggest American railheads, because Andrew Thayer had been the first one to see the potential in shipping west, because Andrew Thayer had seen the potential, and now he, Jack Sawyer, saw the potential as well. All of this was, of course, only intuition, but Jack had come to believe that in these universal matters, his intuition was the only thing he could trust.
"Let go of your passenger, Sloat," Duffery was gobbling. "Let go of your passenger. He's too pretty for you."
But what's a passenger, Jack thought in those last few seconds, as Richard tried blindly to pull them off course, and Jack yanked him back on toward the mixed bunch of mongrels and boys and teachers that ran behind the big white wolf toward the depot. I'll tell you what a passenger is. A passenger is one who rides. And where does a passenger begin to ride? Why, at a depot. "Jack, it'll bite!" Richard screamed. The wolf outran Duffery and leaped at them, its jaws dropping open like a loaded trap. From behind them there was a thick, crunching thud as Nelson House split open like a rotten cantaloupe. Now it was Jack who was bearing down on Richard's finger bones, clamping tight and tighter and tightest as the night rang with crazy bells and flared with gasoline bombs and rattled with firecrackers.
"Hold on!" he screamed. "Hold on, Richard! Here we go!"
He had time to think, now the shoe is on the other foot. Now it's Richard who is the herd, who is my passenger. God help us both.
"Jack, what's happening?" Richard shrieked. "What are you doing? Stop it! Stop it! Stop!"
Richard was still shrieking, but Jack no longer heard him. Suddenly, triumphantly, that feeling of creeping doom cracked open like a black egg, and his brain filled up with light. Light and a sweet purity of air, air so pure that you could smell the radish a man pulled out of his garden half a mile away. Suddenly Jack felt as if he could simply push off and jump all the way across the quad, or fly, like those men with the wings strapped to their backs. Oh, there was light and clear air replacing that foul, garbagey stench, and a sensation of crossing voids of darkness, and for a moment everything in him seemed clear and full of radiance. For a moment everything was rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. So Jack Sawyer flipped into the territories again, this time while running headlong across the degenerating Thayer campus with the sound of cracked bells and snarling dogs filling the air. And this time he dragged Morgan Sloat's son Richard with him. Interlude. Sloat in this world, Oris in the territories, 3. Shortly after 7 a.m., on the morning following Jack and Richard's flip out from Thayer, Morgan Sloat drew up to the curb just outside the main gates of Thayer School. He parked. The space was marked with a handicapped-only sign. Sloat glanced at it indifferently, then reached into his pocket, drew out a vial of cocaine, and used some of it. In a few moments, the world seemed to gain color and vitality. It was wonderful stuff. He wondered if it would grow in the territories, and if it would be more potent over there. Gardner himself had awakened Sloat in his Beverly Hills home at 2 a.m. to tell him what had happened. It had been midnight in Springfield. Gardner's voice had been trembling. He was obviously terrified that Morgan would fly into a rage, and furious that he had missed Jack Sawyer by less than an hour. "That boy! That bad, bad boy!" Sloat had not flown into a rage. Indeed, he had felt extraordinarily calm. He felt a sense of predestination, which he suspected came from that other part of him, what he thought of as his Orisness, in a half-understood pun on royalty.
"Be calm," Sloat had soothed. "I'll be there as soon as I can. Hang in there, baby."
He had broken the connection before Gardner could say any more and lain back on the bed. He had crossed his hands on his stomach and closed his eyes. There was a moment of weightlessness, just a moment, and then he felt a sensation of movement beneath him. He heard the creak of leather traces, the groan and thump of rough iron springs, the curses of his driver. He had opened his eyes as Morgan of Oris. As always, his first reaction was pure delight. This made Coke seem like baby aspirin. His chest was narrower, his weight less. Morgan Sloat's heartbeat ran anywhere from 85 beats a minute to 120 when he was pissed off. Oris's rarely went higher than 65 or so. Morgan Sloat's eyesight was tested at 20/20, but Morgan of Oris nonetheless saw better. He could see and trace the course of every minute crack in the sidewall of the diligence, could marvel over the fineness of the mesh curtains which blew through the windows. Cocaine had clogged Sloat's nose, dulling his sense of smell. Oris's nose was totally clear, and he could smell dust and earth and air with perfect fidelity. It was as if he could sense and appreciate every molecule. Behind him he had left an empty double bed, still marked with the shape of his large body. Here he was sitting on a bench seat, plusher than the seat in any Rolls-Royce ever made, riding west toward the end of the outposts, toward a place which was called Outpost Depot, toward a man named Anders. He knew these things, knew exactly where he was, because Oris was still here, inside his head, speaking to him the way the right side of the brain may speak to the rational left during daydreams, in a low but perfectly clear voice. Sloat had spoken to Oris in this same low undervoice on the few occasions when Oris had migrated to what Jack had come to think of as the American territories. When one migrated and entered the body of one's twinner, the result was a kind of benign possession. Sloat had read of more violent cases of possession, and although the subject did not greatly interest him, he guessed that the poor, unlucky slob so afflicted had been taken over by mad hitchhikers from other worlds. Or perhaps it was the American world itself which had driven them mad. That seemed more than possible. It had certainly done a number on poor old Oris's head the first two or three times he had popped over, although he had been wildly excited as well as terrified. The diligence took a mighty bounce. In the outposts, you took the roads as you found them and thanked God they were there at all. Oris shifted in his seat, and his club foot muttered dull pain. "Hold on steady, God pound you," the driver muttered up above. His whip whistled and popped. "Roll, you sons of dead whores, roll on!" Sloat grinned with the pleasure of being here, even though it would only be for moments. He already knew what he needed to know. Oris's voice had muttered it to him. The diligence would arrive at Outpost Depot, Thayer School in the other world, well before morning. It might be possible to take them there if they had lingered. If not, the blasted lands awaited them. It hurt and enraged him to think that Richard was now with the Sawyer brat. But if a sacrifice was demanded... Well, Oris had lost his son and survived. The only thing that had kept Jack alive this long was the maddening fact of his single nature. When the whelp flipped to a place, he was always in the analog of the place he had left. Sloat, however, always ended up where Oris was, which might be miles away from where he needed to be, as was the case now. He had been lucky at the rest area, but Sawyer had been luckier. "Your luck will run out soon enough, my little friend," Oris said. The diligence took another terrific bounce. He grimaced, then grinned. If nothing else, the situation was simplifying itself, even as the final confrontation took on wider and deeper implications. Enough. He closed his eyes and crossed his arms. For just a moment he felt another dull thud of pain in the deformed foot, and when he opened his eyes, Sloat was looking up at the ceiling of his apartment. As always, there was a moment when the extra pounds fell into him with sickening weight, when his heart reacted with a surprised double beat, and then sped up. He had gotten to his feet then and had called West Coast Business Jet. 70 minutes later he had been leaving LAX. The Lear's steep and abrupt takeoff stance made him feel as it always did. It was as if a blowtorch had been strapped to his ass. They had touched down in Springfield at 5:50 Central Time, just as Oris would be approaching Outpost Depot in the Territories. Sloat had rented a Hertz sedan, and here he was. American travel did have its advantages. He got out of the car, and just as the morning bells began to ring, he walked onto the Thayer campus his own son had so lately quitted. Everything was the essence of an early Thayer weekday morning. The chapel bells were playing a normal morning tune, something classical but not quite recognizable, which sounded a bit like Te Deum but wasn't. Students passed Sloat on their way to the dining hall or to morning workouts. They were perhaps a little more silent than usual, and they shared a look, pale and slightly dazed, as if they had all shared a disquieting dream. Which, of course, they had, Sloat thought. He stopped for a moment in front of Nelson House, looking at it thoughtfully. They simply didn't know how fundamentally unreal they all were, as all creatures who live near the thin places between worlds must be. He walked around to the side and watched a maintenance man picking up broken glass that lay on the ground like trumpery diamonds. Beyond his bent back, Sloat could see into the Nelson House lounge, where an unusually quiet Albert the Blob was sitting and looking blankly at a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Sloat started across toward the depot, his thoughts turning to the first time that Oris had flipped over into this world. He found himself thinking of that time with a nostalgia that was, when one really stopped to think about it, damn near grotesque. After all, he had nearly died. Both of them had nearly died. But it had been in the middle 50s, and now he was in his middle 50s. It made all the difference in the world. He had been coming back from the office, and the sun had been going down in a Los Angeles haze of smudged purples and smoky yellows. This had been in the days before the L.A. smog had really begun to thicken up. He had been on Sunset Boulevard and looking at a billboard advertising a new Peggy Lee record when he had felt a coldness in his mind. It had been as if a wellspring had suddenly opened somewhere in his subconscious, spilling out some alien weirdness that was like semen. Well, he didn't know exactly what it had been like, except that it had quickly become warm, gained cognizance. And he had just had time to realize that it was he, Oris, and then everything had turned topsy-turvy, like a secret door on its gimbal, a bookcase on one side, a Chippendale dresser on the other, both fitting the ambience of the room perfectly, and it had been Oris sitting behind the wheel of a 1952 bullet-nosed Ford, Oris wearing the brown double-breasted suit and the John Penske tie, Oris who was reaching down toward his crotch, not in pain, but in slightly disgusted curiosity, Oris who had, of course, never worn undershorts. There had been a moment, he remembered, when the Ford had nearly driven up onto the sidewalk, and then Morgan Sloat, now very much the undermined, had taken over that part of the operation, and Oris had been free to go along his way, goggling at everything nearly half-mad with delight. And what remained of Morgan Sloat had also been delighted. He had been delighted the way a man is delighted when he shows a friend around his new home for the first time and finds that his friend likes it as much as he likes it himself. Oris had cruised into a Fat Boy drive-in, and after some fumbling with Morgan's unfamiliar paper money, he had ordered a hamburger and French fries and a chocolate thick shake, the words coming easily out of his mouth, welling up from that undermined as water wells up from a spring. Oris's first bite of the hamburger had been tentative, and then he had gobbled the rest with the speed of wolf gobbling his first Whopper. He had crammed the fries into his mouth with one hand while dialing the radio with the other, picking up an enticing babble of pop and Perry Como and some big band and early rhythm and blues. He had sucked down the shake and then had ordered more of everything. Halfway through the second burger, he, Sloat, as well as Oris, began to feel sick. Suddenly the fried onions had seemed too strong, too cloying. Suddenly the smell of car exhaust was everywhere. His arms had suddenly begun to itch madly. He pulled off the coat of the double-breasted suit, the second thick shake, this one mocha, fell unheeded to one side, dribbling ice cream across the Ford seat, and looked at his arms. Ugly red blotches with red centers were growing there and spreading.
His stomach lurched, he leaned out the window, and even as he puked into the tray that was fixed there, he had felt Oris fleeing from him, going back into his own world. "Can I help you, sir?"
"Hm?"
Startled out of his reverie, Sloat looked around. A tall blonde boy, obviously an upperclassman, was standing there. He was dressed prep, an impeccable blue flannel blazer worn over an open-collared shirt and a pair of faded Levi's. He brushed hair out of his eyes, which had that same dazed, dreaming look.
"I'm Etheridge, sir. I just wondered if I could help you. You looked lost."
Sloat smiled. He thought of saying, but did not, "No, that's how you look, my friend." Everything was all right. The Sawyer brat was still on the loose, but Sloat knew where he was going, and that meant that Jackie was on a chain. It was invisible, but it was still a chain. "Lost in the past, that's all," he said. "Old times. I'm not a stranger here, Mr. Etheridge, if that's what you're worried about. My son's a student, Richard Sloat." Etheridge's eyes grew even dreamier for a moment, puzzled, lost. Then they cleared.
"Sure, Richard," he exclaimed.
"I'll be going up to see the headmaster in a bit. I just wanted to have a poke around first."
"Well, I guess that's fine." Etheridge looked at his watch. "I have table duty this morning, so if you're sure you're okay..."
"I'm sure."
Etheridge gave him a nod, a rather vague smile, and started off. Sloat watched him go, and then he surveyed the ground between Nelson House and here, noted the broken window again. A straight shot. It was fair, more than fair, to assume that somewhere between Nelson House and this octagonal brick building, the two boys had migrated into the territories. If he liked, he could follow them. Just step inside, there was no lock on the door, and disappear. Reappear wherever Oris's body happened to be at this moment. It would be somewhere close, perhaps even, in fact, in front of the depot keeper himself. No nonsense about migrating to a spot which might be 100 miles away from the point of interest in territory's geography, and no way to cover the intervening distance but by wagon, or worse, what his father had called Shank's mare. The boys would already have gone on, in all likelihood, into the blasted lands. If so, the blasted lands would finish them. And Sunlight Gardener's twinner, Osmond, would be more than capable of squeezing out all the information that Anders knew. Osmond and his horrid son. No need to migrate at all. Except maybe for a look-see. For the pleasure and refreshment of becoming Oris again, if only for a few seconds. And to make sure, of course. His entire life, from childhood onward, had been an exercise in making sure. He looked around once, to assure himself that Etheridge had not lingered. Then he opened the door of the depot and went inside. The smell was stale, dark, and incredibly nostalgic. The smell of old makeup and canvas flats. For a moment he had the crazy idea that he had done something even more incredible than migrating. He felt that he might have traveled back through time to those undergraduate days when he and Phil Sawyer had been theater-mad college students. Then his eyes adjusted to the dimness, and he saw the unfamiliar, almost mawkish props. A plaster bust of Pallas for a production of The Raven, an extravagantly gilt birdcage, a bookcase full of false bindings, and remembered that he was in the Thayer School excuse for a little theater. He paused for a moment, breathing deeply of the dust. He turned his eyes up to one dusty sunray falling through a small window. The light wavered and was suddenly a deeper gold, the color of lamplight. He was in the territories. Just like that, he was in the territories. There was a moment of almost staggering exhilaration at the speed of the change. Usually there was a pause, a sense of side-slipping from one place to another. This caesura seemed to be in direct proportion to the distance between the physical bodies of his two selves, Sloat and Oris. Once, when he had migrated from Japan, where he was negotiating a deal with the Shaw brothers for a terrible novel about Hollywood stars menaced by a crazed ninja, the pause had gone on so long that he feared he might be lost forever somewhere in the empty, senseless purgatory that exists between the worlds.
But this time they had been close, so close. It was like those few times, he thought, Oris thought, when a man and woman achieve orgasm at the exact same instant and die in sex together. The smell of dried paint and canvas was replaced with the light, pleasant smell of territory's burning oil. The lamp on the table was guttering low, sending out dark membranes of smoke. To his left, a table was set, the remains of a meal congealing on the rough plates. Three plates. Oris stepped forward, dragging his club foot a little, as always. He tipped one of the plates up, let the guttering lamplight skate queasily across the grease. Who ate from this one? Was it Anders, or Jason, or Richard? The boy would also have been Rushton if my son had lived. Rushton had drowned while swimming in a pond not far from the great house. There had been a picnic. Oris and his wife had drunk a quantity of wine. The sun had been hot. The boy, little more than an infant, had been napping. Oris and his wife had made love, and then they had also fallen asleep in the sweet afternoon sunshine. He had been awakened by the child's cries. Rushton had awakened and gone down to the water. He had been able to dog paddle a little, just enough to get well out beyond his depth before panicking. Oris had limped to the water, dived in, and swum as fast as he could out to where the boy floundered. It was his foot, his damned foot, that had hampered him and perhaps cost his son his life. When he reached the boy, he had been sinking. Oris had managed to catch him by the hair and pull him to shore, but by then Rushton had been blue and dead. Margaret had died by her own hand less than 6 weeks later. 7 months after that, Morgan Sloat's own young son had nearly drowned in a Westwood YMCA pool during a young paddler's class. He had been pulled from the pool as blue and dead as Rushton, but the lifeguard had applied mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and Richard Sloat had responded. God pounds his nails, Oris thought, and then a deep, blurry snore snapped his head around. Anders, the depot keeper, lay on a pallet in the corner with his kilt rudely pulled up to his breeks. An earthen jug of wine lay overturned nearby. Much of the wine had flowed into his hair. He snored again, then moaned, as if with bad dreams. No dream you might have could be as bad as your future now is, Oris thought grimly. He took a step closer, his cloak flapping around him. He looked down on Anders with no pity. Sloat was able to plan murder, but it had been Oris, time and time again, who had migrated to carry out the act itself. It had been Oris in Sloat's body who had attempted to smother the infant Jack Sawyer with a pillow while a wrestling announcer droned on and on in the background. Oris, who had overseen the assassination of Phil Sawyer in Utah, just as he had overseen the assassination of Phil Sawyer's counterpart, the commoner Prince Philip Sawtell in the territories. Sloat had a taste for blood, but ultimately he was as allergic to it as Oris was to American food and American air. It was Morgan of Oris, once derided as Morgan Thudfoot, who had always done the deeds Sloat had planned. My son died. His still lives. Sawtell's son died. Sawyer's still lives. But these things can be remedied, will be remedied. No talisman for you, my sweet little friends. You are bound for a radioactive version of Oatley, and you each owe the balance scales a death. God pounds his nails. And if God doesn't, you may be sure I will, he said aloud. The man on the floor moaned again as if he had heard. Oris took another step toward him, perhaps meaning to kick him awake, and then cocked his head. In the distance he heard hoofbeats, the faint creak and jingle of harness, the hoarse cries of drovers. That would be Osmond, then. Good. Let Osmond take care of business here. He himself had little interest in questioning a man with a hangover when he knew well enough what the man would have to say. Oris clumped across to the door, opened it, and looked out on a gorgeous peach-colored territory sunrise. It was from this direction, the direction of the sunrise, that the sounds of approaching riders came. He allowed himself to drink in that lovely glow for a moment, and then turned toward the west again, where the sky was still the color of a fresh bruise. The land was dark, except for where the first sunlight bounced off a pair of bright, parallel lines. "Boys, you have gone to your deaths," Oris thought with satisfaction. And then a thought occurred, which brought even more satisfaction. Their deaths might already have happened.
"Good," Oris said, and closed his eyes.
A moment later, Morgan Sloat was gripping the handle of the door of Thayer School's little theater, opening his own eyes, and planning his trip back to the West Coast. It might be time to take a little trip down memory lane, he thought, to a town in California called Point Venuti. A trip back east first, perhaps a visit to the Queen, and then... "The sea air," he said to the bust of Pallas, "will do me good." He ducked back inside, had another jolt from the small vial in his pocket, hardly noticing the smells of canvas and makeup now. And, thus refreshed, he started back downhill toward his car.
Part 4. The Talisman. Chapter 34. Anders.
Jack suddenly realized that although he was still running, he was running on thin air, like a cartoon character who has time for one surprise double take before plunging 2,000 feet straight down. But it wasn't 2,000 feet. He had time, just, to realize that the ground wasn't there anymore, and then he dropped 4 or 5 feet, still running. He wobbled and might have remained upright, but then Richard came piling into him and they both went tumbling.
"Look out, Jack!"
Richard was screaming. He was apparently not interested in taking his own advice, because his eyes were squeezed tightly shut.
"Look out for the wolf! Look out for Mr. Duffery! Look out! Stop it, Richard!"
These breathless screams frightened him more than anything else had done. Richard sounded mad, absolutely mad.
"Stop it! We're all right! They're gone!" "Look out for Etheridge! Look out for the bugs! Look out, Jack!"
"Richard, they're gone! Look around you, for Jason's sake!" Jack hadn't had a chance to do this himself, but he knew they had made it. The air was still and sweet, the night perfectly silent, except for a slim breeze that was blessedly warm.
"Look out, Jack! Look out, Jack! Look out! Look out!"
Like a bad echo inside his head, he heard a memory of the dog boys outside Nelson House chorusing, "Wake up! Wake up! Wake up! Please, please, please!"
"Look out, Jack!"
Richard wailed. His face was slammed into the earth, and he looked like an overenthusiastic Muslim, determined to get in good with Allah.
"Look out, the wolf! Prefects, the headmaster! Look out!"
Panicked by the idea that Richard actually had gone crazy, Jack yanked his friend's head up by the back of his collar and slapped his face. Richard's words were cut cleanly off. He gaped at Jack, and Jack saw the shape of his own hand rising on Richard's pale cheek, a dim red tattoo. His shame was replaced by an urgent curiosity to know just where they were. There was light, otherwise he wouldn't have been able to see that mark. A partial answer to the question came from inside him. It was certain and unquestionable, at least as far as it went. "The outposts, Jacko. You're in the outposts now." But before he could spend any time mulling that over, he had to try to get Richard shipshape. "Are you all right, Richie?" He was looking at Jack with numb, hurt surprise.
"You hit me, Jack."
"I slapped you. That's what you're supposed to do with hysterical people."
"I wasn't hysterical. I've never been hysterical in my
Richard broke off and jumped to his feet, looking around wildly.
"The wolf! We have to look out for the wolf, Jack. If we can get over the fence, he won't be able to get us."
He would have gone sprinting off into the darkness right then, making for a cyclone fence which was now in another world, if Jack hadn't grabbed him and held him back.
"The wolf is gone, Richard."
"Huh?"
"We made it."
"What are you talking about?"
"The territories, Richard.
We're in the territories. We flipped over, and you almost pulled my damn arm out of its socket, you unbeliever," Jack thought, rubbing his throbbing shoulder. "The next time I try to haul someone across, I'm going to find myself a real little kid, one who still believes in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny."
"That's ridiculous," Richard said slowly.
There's no such thing as the territories, Jack.
If there isn't, Jack said grimly, then how come that great big white wolf isn't biting your ass, or your own damn headmaster?
Richard looked at Jack, opened his mouth to say something, then closed it again. He looked around, this time with a bit more attention, at least Jack hoped so. Jack did the same, enjoying the warmth and the clarity of the air as he did so. Morgan and his crowd of snake pit crazies might come bursting through at any second, but for now it was impossible not to luxuriate in the pure animal joy of being back here again. They were in a field, high yellowish grass with bearded heads, not wheat, but something like wheat, some edible grain anyway, stretched off into the night in every direction. The warm breeze rippled it in mysterious but rather lovely waves. To the right was a wooden building standing on a slight knoll, a lamp mounted on a pole in front of it. A yellow flame, almost too bright to look at, burned clearly inside the lamp's glass globe. Jack saw that the building was octagonal. The two boys had come into the territories on the outermost edge of the circle of light that lamp threw, and there was something on the far side of the circle, something metallic, that threw back the lamplight in broken glimmers. Jack squinted at the faint, silvery glow, and then understood. What he felt was not so much wonder as a sense of fulfilled expectation. It was as if two very large jigsaw puzzle pieces, one in the American territories and one over here, had just come neatly together. Those were railroad tracks. And although it was impossible to tell direction in the darkness, Jack thought he knew in which direction those tracks would travel. West.
Come on, Jack said.
I don't want to go up there, Richard said.
Why not?
Too much crazy stuff going on.
Richard wet his lips.
Could be anything up there in that building. Dogs, crazy people.
He wet his lips again.
Bugs?
I told you we're in the territories now. The craziness has all blown away. It's clean here.
Hell, Richard, can't you smell it?
There are no such things as territories, Richard said thinly.
Look around you.
No,
Richard said.
His voice was thinner than ever, the voice of an infuriatingly stubborn child. Jack snatched up a handful of the heavily bearded grass.
Look at this.
Richard turned his head. Jack had to actively restrain an urge to shake him. Instead of doing that, he tossed the grass away, counted mentally to 10, and then started up the hill. He looked down and saw that he was now wearing something like leather chaps. Richard was dressed in much the same way, and he had a red bandana around his neck that looked like something out of a Frederick Remington painting. Jack reached up to his own neck and felt a similar bandana. He ran his hands down along his body and discovered that Miles P. Kiger's wonderfully warm coat was now something very like a Mexican serape. I bet I look like an advertisement for Taco Bell, he thought, and grinned. An expression of utter panic came over Richard's face when Jack started up the hill, leaving him alone at the bottom.
Where are you going?
Jack looked at Richard and came back. He put his hands on Richard's shoulders and looked soberly into Richard's eyes.
We can't stay here, he said.
Some of them must have seen us flip. It may be that they can't come right after us, or it may be that they can. I don't know. I know as much about the laws governing all of this as a kid of 5 knows about magnetism. And all a kid of 5 knows on the subject is that sometimes magnets attract and sometimes they repel. But for the time being, that's all I have to know. We have to get out of here. End of story.
I'm dreaming all this. I know I am.
Jack nodded toward the ramshackle wooden building.
You can come or you can stay here. If you want to stay here, I'll come back for you after I check the place out.
None of this is happening, Richard said.
His naked, glasses-less eyes were wide and flat and somehow dusty. He looked for a moment up at the black territory sky with its strange and unfamiliar sprawl of stars, shuddered, and looked away.
I have a fever. It's the flu. There's been a lot of flu around. This is a delirium. You're guest starring in my delirium, Jack.
Well, I'll send somebody around to the Delirium Actors Guild with my aftercard when I get a chance, Jack said. In the meantime, why don't you just stay here, Richard? If none of this is happening, then you have nothing to worry about. He started away again, thinking that it would take only a few more of these Alice at the Tea Party conversations with Richard to convince him that he was crazy as well. He was halfway up the hill when Richard joined him. I would have come back for you, Jack said.
I know, Richard said. I just thought that I might as well come along, as long as all of this is a dream anyway.
Well, keep your mouth shut if there's anyone up there, Jack said. I think there is. I think I saw someone looking out that front window at me.
What are you going to do? Richard asked.
Jack smiled.